The Bible says that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. This is foundational to Christian faith. And this very statement is being challenged today by many men who claim to be scientists and who have studied in the areas of science. They have a way of sort of putting down anybody who does not agree with their belief in the theory of evolution, that there is no necessity for a creator, that all things have been brought into existence by natural processes over billions of years of time. It's our privilege to have today as our speaker a man who is a renowned scientist, Dr. A.E. Wilder Smith. He studied the natural sciences at Oxford University in England. He received his first doctorate in physical organic chemistry at Reading University in England in 1941. And during the World War II, he joined the research department of ICI in England. And after the war, he became Countess of Lisbon Memorial Fellow at the University of London. Subsequently, Dr. Wilder Smith was appointed Director of Research for a Swiss pharmaceutical company. And later, he received his habilitation, the senior examination required for professorial appointments to the European Continental Universities. At Geneva, he earned his second doctorate, followed by a third doctorate from the ETH, a senior university in Switzerland, in Zurich. 1957-58, Dr. Wilder Smith was the visiting assistant professor at the Medical Center of the University of Illinois. In 1959-61, he was the visiting full professor of pharmacology at the University of Bergen in Norway. Then he was appointed full professor of pharmacology at the University of Illinois, and there he received three Golden Apple Awards for the best course lectures, together with four senior lecturer awards for the best series of senior year lectures. Dr. Wilder Smith is a well-known speaker on many other topics than creationism. He is the author or co-author of over 70 scientific publications, and he has authored more than 30 books. I believe that you'll find his lecture very interesting today as he lectures to us on the subject, why the theory of evolution is not scientific. Dr. Wilder Smith.
Now that's a highly un-British thing to do. You shouldn't clap beforehand, because after 10 minutes you might want to unclap me. You see? That would be a bad thing to do, wouldn't it? It's rather difficult to do. But we'll carry on. Now I'm going to talk to you about evolution this morning, because I don't think there's any subject which is so falsely presented in the intellectual world today is that subject. And people don't get ratty over subjects as much as they get over evolution. They really do lose their tempers, and they get hot under the collar, and they'll call you all sorts of nasty names, which I just ignore, you see. I don't call them back nasty names, but what I'm going to talk about evolution today is this. It's really a basic problem of thinking, and thinking straight. It's very difficult, you know, to think straight. If you're always taught that 2 plus 2 equals 5, say your mathematics teacher taught you that, in the end you'd believe that 2 plus 2 equals 5. You would, and then you'd never be able to do any mathematics again, would you? that would finish you off. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do any calculus or any bookkeeping or anything like that. So you must get the basics right. Now, the biologists have seen for years the fact that there is a gradation of complexity in the biological world. You see the amoeba. You've all seen amoeba, haven't you, under the microscope? You have? Don't say you haven't. You have. Okay. Well, you see, it goes up, you get paramecium and all the other little things, and you get below them the bacteria and the viruses, and then you go up to the tadpoles and the frogs and the amphibia, and then you go to the reptiles, and then you go to the octopuses. You've all seen octopuses, haven't you? You have, haven't you? Uh-huh. What sort of an eye do they have? An eye. Have you ever looked into their eyes? Oh, you want to have a look at them. We've seen lots of them in the Canary Islands, in the Atlantic, you know, belongs to Spain. They pull them out, big fellows, out of the water, and squint their eyes closed because the light's too bright for them, you see. And then they try to hop off on their eight tentacles back to the sea again. And they always get caught because the fishermen like to eat them there. Anyway, you find all these things have a gradation of complexity. The amoeba is much more simple than, say, the frog. And the frog is much more simple than the crocodile. And the crocodile is more simple than, say, the wolf. And the wolf is not so complex as the monkey. And the monkey is, well, he's sometimes quite complex, isn't he, the monkey? But they find this gradation in the biological spectrum. And therefore, if you were to say today that, therefore, on the basis of the spectrum you see today, the amoeba developed into Homo sapiens sapiens, you'd say that is, let me see if they know, did you do any Latin? Do you know what a non sequitur means? N-O-N, sequitur. Where's the board? Let me see if you do know what that is, and I'll give you a better grade then, you see. Now, do you know what that means? It's very important when you're arguing with people that you know the terms. A non sequitur means a step which is not logical. Something which doesn't follow. You'll find this in all types of arguments in science and in languages, the use of that term. Now, it would be, wouldn't it, a non sequitur to say that because there are amoeba, and because there are frogs, and because there are monkeys, and because there are man, that therefore the amoeba gave rise to the man. That is the evolution of the amoeba to man. But you see, because you've seen a gradation like that in the fossil world, in the formations, they say that gradation must really mean that one is developed from the other. Well, it doesn't follow, does it? And that's just what a non sequitur means, it doesn't follow. Now, there is a gradation in the fossils. Don't let's argue about that, there is. But to say that because there's a gradation, therefore one developed from another, is an entirely different kettle of fish. Okay? Now, that's what the evolutionary theory was developed for, to explain this gradation of complexity from one to another in scientific terms. And Darwin came up with the idea that if a cell replicates, now you all know what replication means, don't you? You do. Dead silence. Well, I'm going to put it up in case you get stuck, because I wouldn't like that. If it multiplies, okay, replication is the right term, multiplies is the general term, then Darwin said they'll be different, the offspring, they'll compete with one another, and only the efficient and the fit will live, the others will die. So the creative method, they said, depends upon the killing of the unfit and the preservation of the fit. So God's creative method according to Darwin, was evolution, Darwinian evolution. Now let's have a look at the postulates on which the evolutionary theory is based. We've got them here, and I've taken them from Professor G.A. Kirkert's book, which is published in England, and which is a very good book. He is an evolutionist, he believes in evolution. He was trained in Cambridge, so he ought to be okay, oughtn't he? Ought to be okay. But he is very good. He's professor now at Southampton in the southern part of England, and he wrote a book called The Implications of Evolution. Now in that book he says, let's just have a look carefully on what all evolutionary theory is based. He says the first postulate they make is that non-living matter, what's non-living matter? What is non-living matter? What does that mean? Yes. What does non-living matter mean? How would you say it? Oh, you all sleep. Well, it means life that's inorganic, that isn't alive. Say crystals of granite and rock and all the rest of it, okay? Non-living matter spontaneously produced living matter at biogenesis. Now, you know what biogenesis means, don't you? The genesis of life, that is the starting of life. That is that life started from non-living matter spontaneously. You didn't have to do anything about it. A creative act of God was not necessary. As long as you got matter, Darwin believed that God made matter. But he didn't think that God acted on matter to make life out of it. That is, now you're listening very carefully, Darwin, in his early days, was a Christian. And he was a theist. That is, he believed in God, and God made matter. He was a creationist, if you like. Now, in his later days, he became, I'm going to put this up so you can see, he was a theist. That is, that God made matter, and then he acted on matter and produced life. And that is theism, that God does act today, that he does things for us. Now, Darwin became, in the course of his life, a deist. That is, he thought that God made the world and then just retired and didn't do anything more, and God was dead. Plenty of God is dead people, they don't think God acts, you know, today. So he became a deist. He never became an atheist, Darwin. He was always a deist until he died. Atheist, I'll put that up so you've got the three there. Now that's the first postulate, that non-living matter without any creative act of God produced living matter to produce the first living cell. That's postulate number one. What scientific proof have we got of that? None. There isn't any. So we'll put down to one postulate, we'll put down a little cross. There's not a tick or anything like that to show it was true. Now postulate two says this, that spontaneous biogenesis, according to one, that's this one here, occurred only once, so that all present day life descended from one single cell. Now why did they say that? That this spontaneous development of life occurred only once, yeah? Oh no, not really. That's not the reason. You see, if they hadn't been able to get it in laboratories, that would mean that this is wrong, wouldn't it? Because you can't repeat it. Now, there's never been any repetition of that. If you put a lot of matter, say you put dead sardines in a can, we do that on quite a large scale, don't we? Now, I don't, personally, but I like sardines. But you've never seen a sardine can which is dead and there's no life in it. You've never seen it produce life, have you? I haven't either. So to say this, you've got in a sardine can, you've got all the forms of life, all the elements you need to life, because they were hopping little fish at one time, weren't they? They ought to be all right to come to life. But we've done that experiment millions of times, every time we've made a sardine can, and there's never any life come out of it, right or wrong. So we can say to one, there's no scientific proof of it at all. Now, can we say spontaneous generation, spontaneous biogenesis, according to one, occurred only once, so that life, present-day life, descended from one single cell? Is that true or wrong? Is it true, right, or wrong? Come on, don't be afraid. They tell me I'm a Britisher, you see, and the British don't have an eagle for their national sign, do they? You know what they do have. Come on, who teaches you your history? Who teaches you your geography? I'll go and complain. A lion, the British lion. Anybody think I was that, wouldn't you? Where you answer me. Well, you get two. There's no evidence that that occurred only once. But what? Why do they say it then, if there's no evidence for it? Well, if this doesn't occur, then this falls apart, doesn't it? There's no point in going on. If you don't get life, there's no evolution, so drop the whole matter. That's quite clear. But you see here, your spontaneous biogenesis occurring only once. What's the reason they say that? You must think what other people think, you know, that you never get at people's minds unless you think as they do, or try to understand why they think as they do. The reason is that the genetic code in all life is the same. The genetic code in you, I mean how it works, the codons and all the rest of it, and the ribosomes, is the same in you as it is in a frog or a cauliflower, isn't it? You know that, don't you? So they say, well, it's unlikely that a genetic code like that, complicated as it is, would have formed twice exactly the same, by chance. If it had formed a second time, it would probably be different to what it did the first time. So they say, as in all nature, it is the same, therefore, all nature is derived from one cell. That is, this postulate too. Now, is that reasonable? I don't think it's reasonable at all, because you see, I don't think a genetic code, a language, would ever be formed by chance anyway. So this business about spontaneously here is anyway, it makes the whole business very doubtful, doesn't it? Okay? Now, there's one thing here which you ladies and gentlemen like to know. What is the basis of a scientific fact? When do you accept a fact as scientific? When it can be repeated, that's right. Well now, has it ever been repeated that from one cell, other cells arose? Different cells arose, higher cells? You can't repeat it, that's the trouble. But you see, they say that it only occurred once. If they say it only occurred once and you can't do it again, they're saying it's unscientific. So, written right bang in the middle, this is all scientific nonsense which we're teaching you, because you can't repeat it. It occurred only once. So if you keep your eyes open, you see, the old English proverb is this, that if you give enough rope to a calf, it'll always hang itself. So you give enough rope to the evolutionists and they'll hang themselves, because they've done it here, you see. Spontaneous biogenesis, according to one, occurred only once. Well, if it occurred only once and you can never repeat it, why bother about it? Because it isn't scientific. It's only scientific if you can repeat it. You look very unhappy about this. Is this true or is it not? I used to say, boys, look, this is an idea. Let's write this large on in our head so that we know how to talk to people. And you'll be able to talk to your teacher, you see, which is always an advantage. Now, the third thing is, the different viruses, bacteria, plants and animals, all descended from one another. They're all interrelated. What about that one? Would you say that a fly is related to you? Would you say that a fly is your great uncle, to put it like, to put it very, very crudely? No, but I mean, they're so different, aren't they? I mean, flies know enough about us to annoy us, don't they? But I don't think that you could say they've got anywhere related to us, except their genetic code. Their genetic code is very similar to ours. That is, the mechanism by which the information is retained, stored and retrieved is very similar. But I wouldn't say a fly's eye looks like your eye, does it? And a fly's brain, well, you're not pinheads, are you? So I think you're all right there. So that one, you see, we'll put that one down as unscientific, number two. And number three, to say they are descended from one another is just a statement. There's no proof about it. This is the basis of evolution. These are the implications of evolution, the seven main postulates of the theory of evolution. So we've got three now, and none of them is scientific. You can't repeat them. And if you can't repeat them, they're unscientific. Okay? Let's go on to four then. If you have any questions, you know, you can ask them. Number four, the metazoa. Now, what are the metazoans? Biology class, the elite of Costa Mesa here. What are the metazoans? I shall go and complain to your teacher. Oh, he's standing at the back, so we'll get him in the corner at the end. What are the metazoans? They're many-celled organisms. The metazoans are spontaneously developed from the protozoans. What's a protozoan? Single-celled organism, that's right. So they're saying that the single-celled organisms spontaneously developed into multi-celled organisms. Now, we were all, at one time, single-celled organisms, weren't we? The fertilized ovum was a single cell. Anybody who doesn't know might mistake it for an amoeba, but if you do know, you don't. The amoeba developed up to us, and we've got millions of cells in us, haven't we? So the metazoans developed in us from the protozoan, from the egg, okay? Now, they said that was spontaneous. Why do we do that? Because we've got the information and the programming to do it, haven't we? But to say then that an amoeba could develop spontaneously, a protozoan, could develop spontaneously to a metazoan, is to say that a program could arise spontaneously by random events. Now, have you ever known a program to arise by random events? If you go and tell that to the Bell Telephone Company, or to Hewlett-Packard, or anybody like that around here, you go and tell them that, they'll have you certified on the spot, and they'll take you home in a little police car and put you in chains, and that'll be it. Because the only way you can get a metazoa out of a protozoan is by putting in an extra program, just as we've got it in us. And then we became human beings. You see, a woman never bears a crocodile, does she? Nor does she bear an octopus, nor does she bear a cauliflower. Why? Because the program for a cauliflower is different to the program for a baby. That's the reason. So if you say this, number four, the metazoans developed out of the protozoans, you're saying that the program necessary to make a protozoan, to make a metazoan out of a protozoan, that program arises by spontaneous events, random events. That is, you're saying that programming takes place spontaneously. Does it? Well, if it doesn't, we shall have to put a zero down for that one, shouldn't we? It doesn't, believe me. Otherwise, there's no reason why a woman shouldn't bear a cauliflower. Because a cauliflower's got the same type of genetic code as we have, but the information on it, the programming on it, is different, that's all. So you've got to have the right programming to get that to go. And if you think the right programming occurs by this, that's the whole trouble with Darwinism. They didn't know anything about programming in those days. Darwin, you see, lived over 100 years ago, and he didn't know anything about programming. So the poor old man had to make his theories up out of his own head, with the consequence that he made some bad mistakes. Well, it's time today that we corrected those mistakes. We don't want to hurt the old man, he just didn't know better. But we just want to say, but you can't believe that today because we know about programming. Now, the fifth one is the invertebrates are phylogenetically interrelated. Now, what does that mean? It means the invertebrates are the flies, the ants, the termites, the octopuses, the squids, and all those sorts of gentlemen. Now, you know all about them, don't you? You do know what invertebrates are. I shall have to have a talk to your teacher about this afterwards if you don't. Well, now, to say they're all interrelated, to say that a fly is related to an octopus is very nice. The genetic code by which it stores its information may be related, but the program on that genetic code is certainly not very near anyway. So I should say this, that if we say that, can we prove it? Well, if you say, because I say that the fly is related to a termite, therefore it must be true, I think that is a non sequitur, and it doesn't follow. So I'm going to put down for the five here, because I've got a lot to do. How's the time? I've got a lot to do. We're going to put down a cross there. There's not a single point that we found that's right until now. Let's get on to number six. The vertebrates are phylogenetically related to the invertebrates. That is, the animals with a backbone are related phylogenetically. You know what phylogenetically means, don't you? In their ancestral tree. In their ancestral tree. They bred from the invertebrates, is what it means. In their ancestral tree. In their ancestral tree. They bred from the invertebrates, is what it means. Well, I don't know. You can say that if you like, but there's no proof of it. And if you can't repeat it, in the lab, I should say, well, why talk such bunkum? Because all I'm interested is in things you can repeat in the lab as a scientist. Well, now, I can't repeat it, so I'll put six down and say, on that basis of who said it's got to be repeatable to be scientific? Who said that? Pardon? You did. Okay, you're right. You're quite right. Sir Karl Popper put it in nice scientific language, didn't he, the philosopher, the old man. He said that evolution is a metaphysical research program. And because he used that nasty word metaphysical, they were very, 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 very annoyed with him. So when they tackled him on, he said, will you repeat it? And then I say, it isn't metaphysical. And as they couldn't repeat it, he said, well, okay, let it stand. It's all zeros. Now, let's go on to the seventh then, sixth, seventh. The vertebrates are phylogenetically related. Now, if you look at the vertebrates with their system of backbone, you see, and arms, forelimbs, and eyes, and all the rest of it, they're pretty alike, aren't they? I mean, let's own up to it. We are like the monkeys, aren't we? You've only got to go outside the chimpanzee cage and see it with their antics to see how they plague one another and throw things at human beings when there's mud around to splash their white clothes, you see, and they delight, they'll howl with laughter when they make you dirty and you have to run for it. I mean, there is a lot of likeness there, but I wouldn't say that likeness is enough to prove that we're interrelated, is it? You all know General Montgomery, don't you? The British general who worked with Eisenhower and, you know, won the war. He had a double. You know what a double is, don't you? Somebody who looked exactly like him. And what the British did, they took this double who looked exactly like Montgomery, and they trained him to make all the funny little things that Montgomery did. You see, he'd twiddle his hair and twiddle his moustache, and he didn't have a moustache, but he'd do all those little things that some people do. And they trained this double to do all those things, and they dressed him up in a general's uniform. And just before they were going to go across the channel and do the invasion, they sent this double of Montgomery, with a nice political send-off, they sent him down to Libya, so that the Germans would think that Montgomery wasn't going to do any invading. He was gone down to Libya, and they swallowed it, and they weren't ready for the invasion because they thought that Montgomery was down in the Mediterranean. Now listen, you wouldn't say therefore, because the double looked exactly like Montgomery, that he was his brother, would you? You may look alike, but that's no proof of phylogenetic relationship. Okay? We right? Would you accept that one? Well, okay, I'll accept it. You need to do it if you don't want to. But I think that there's no real scientific proof for that. So we've got the seven main postulates on which the whole evolutionary theory is built. And not one of them, as Professor Kirkert, who is professor of evolution and is an evolutionist himself, he says there's not one of them is scientific. Now, you ought to have the book here for your kids to read. This is required reading for the evolutionary course. It's a good book to read. Now, if you take a can of sardines, we'll go back to the can of sardines, because they're very useful little animals, not only to eat, but to understand. They're in a can, aren't they? And they're sealed. They're hermetically sealed, aren't they? Do you think that the conditions in a can of sardines at room temperature would be capable of bearing life? Well, they were alive at one time, so at one time they must have been capable of bearing life, mustn't they? What's the only thing that's gone wrong with them? Well, you've killed them. They starved them to death, you see. They starved them so their stomachs were empty. And when they starved them, they sterilized them and put them in cans. Now, you would think that if there's any form of inorganic, non-living matter, sardines would be the ideal material to make life from, wouldn't you? Because they were once alive. Once hopping little fish, weren't they? Are you in agreement with me here? Because I need your agreement on this. We must go forward by agreement. If you put those sardines into a can, the evolutionists say that what made life on Earth was the rays of the sun reacting on inorganic matter, which produced life, that financed life. That's what they say. As long as the sun shone, you see, on the inorganic matter, there's a chance from the energy of the sun to increase the order of the inorganic matter right up to the order of living matter. Okay? That's what they say. Now then, let's have a look at our sardines. They're in a can. Is a can physically an open system or not? Now, you know what an open system is, don't you? An open system is a system in physics which will allow energy in and energy out. Do you think that energy can get into a sardine can? And can it get out? Well, of course it can, because you can heat it up. You make a sardine can up with boiling water up to 100 degrees centigrade, can't you? It's easy. So you can get energy in. Now, can you get it out again? Put it in the deep freezer, and you'll get it down to minus 20 degrees centigrade, won't you? So you can get your energy in and out. So you're in the same position as the inorganic matter on the Earth, aren't you? The sun shines on the Earth. And they say from the sunshine on the Earth, that will give the energy which is necessary to make life from inorganic matter. Okay? Are we agreed with one another on that? Now, we've made billions of sardine cans, haven't we? Billions of them. God, you see them making sardine cans up in Norway, up in Bergen, where we used to live. It's amazing. Now, each sardine can, then, is an experiment in biogenesis. Because if energy can get into those cans, and if energy can get out, they're an open system. And according to evolution, you ought to get life out of them. Now, we're perfectly convinced, and your Ministry of Health and Ministry of Agriculture is perfectly convinced that in a can of sardines, here we are, here's our can of sardines, in a can of sardines, life will, here's the little corpses of the sardines in there, you see. I'm a bit of a Picasso, but I've never made the fortune that Picasso made from doing that sort of thing. Here they are in the cans of sardines, and the energy is going in and the energy is going out. Okay, now we've done that billions of times. Do you think that this has ever been produced that way? Life has ever come out of a can of sardines? It ought to, if it's right, isn't it? I mean, you've done it billions of times, and it's never happened. Why?
Well, look, I'll tell you this, that nobody in your Department of Agriculture or in the Department of Agriculture of any civilized nation believes in the remotest way that that is possible. Because if they thought that life would start from sardine cans and you couldn't control what sort of life, they'd be terrified that some bug would arise which would kill us all. They are with cloning. They're afraid that we should produce something which will be toxic to us from inorganic matter and kill us all. So they won't let us do certain forms of cloning. But you see, they're so convinced that sardine cans will never produce anything in the way of life that they allow you to can sardines. So they don't believe the onus of the sardine factories. They don't believe in postulate number one. Otherwise they'd forbid the canning of sardines. Because they're perfect, a perfect medium to produce biogenesis, aren't they? Now look, we've got just a minute to do this. How could you get life out of a can of sardines? You can't get it by putting in energy. Because if you put in energy and make it hot, then they get off tastes, don't they? They don't taste nice. So you can't get it out of putting life energy in, and nor can you do it by cooling them down. Because they've had some cans of sardines, you know, found up in the Antarctica, also in Arctica, which have been in the ice for 100 years. You know, when people died, like Scott and company, they found their food stores, and they're perfectly fresh. Perfectly all right. They were in sardine cans, you see. So they're all right. There's nothing happened to them. And they're so sure that nothing will happen to them, that no life will be produced which might be toxic to us, that they allow canning. When they stop canning and say life might arise that way, then I'll believe that they believe in evolution. Not before. Then they say, look here, boys, these sardine cans are ideal to make some form of life which will kill us all, that we won't allow it, then I believe that they believe in evolution. But in actual fact, all the canning industry is sure that life never arises that way, otherwise they'd never allow it. If there were one in a million chance of killing people and getting bacteria formed, or other organisms which would kill us, they'd never allow it. Okay? So in their hearts, they say they believe in evolution, and in their practice, they demonstrate that they certainly don't. Okay? Now listen. This is the practical part, and with that I finish. How could you get life out of a can of sardines? How could you do it, practically, and scientifically so you could repeat it? Yes, sir? Well, that would be swindling a bit. I say, how are you going to get... I always like to be absolutely fair in what I do, even with those people... I don't like, you know, I try to be fair, because otherwise they've got a reason not for not liking me. How would you do it without swindling? Come on, we haven't got much time, so you have to get those cogwheels turning around. Yes. Pardon? Yeah, but they're all dead. How could they lay eggs if they're dead? You're right, you're getting on. Come along, we're getting nearer, we're getting warmer, as they say in England. How would you do it? Well, I'll give you an idea. And if you say the idea is good, say hi. And if you think the idea is bad, say no. Okay? If you were to put in to this can of sardines a DNA molecule which had all the information necessary to make Escherichia coli. Now, you all know what Escherichia coli is, don't you? It's one of the... Oh, you do. If you don't know that, I shall complain to your teacher. If you were to put in a DNA molecule which has all the information to make an Escherichia coli, which is a bacterium out of your digestive tract, so you couldn't digest your lunch without them. They're most useful little gentlemen. If you were to put that DNA molecule in, which has the E. coli information on it, a whole bag of tricks here would spring into life and would produce Escherichia coli. That's the way it's done. All you do is you insert the information necessary for life you insert the programs which in each case we didn't have in Darwinism. And if you do that, then life will just simply blow the can up. Okay? Now, you could do it another way, couldn't you? If you were in a sterile bubble, like some poor children that have got diseases, you see, that they can't get the immune system to work, if you were to give the sardines to a person in a sterile bubble, he would take, she would take the sardines and convert them into human life, because the program is there. So if you were to put, theoretically, if you were to put a human egg in that and simulate a human uterus, you get a baby out. So what is lacking here is not the inorganic matter. It's not the fact that the temperature's right or wrong. What is lacking is the program for life. Okay? So if you want to get life, the way to do it is to take matter, M, okay, and add to it T, tempus, time, and add to it E, there's your sunlight if you want E, okay, and add to it a programmed information storage and retrieval system, and then you get out life. You get out the cell. That's the way it's done. But you see, Darwin says this. This is to reduce it to something very simple. Darwin says this: matter plus time plus energy equals the cell. So his formula is not wrong. What do you gather from that formula? What's the correct term? It's deficient. It's deficient. So the Darwinian formula is not so wrong as it is deficient. Okay? So if you add to the Darwinian formula the program, which you can call logos if you like, because logos is a concept, and a program is a concept. Okay? All right? If you add that, how bag of tricks in order? And the error of Darwinism is so simple that even the great brains very often haven't seen it. It's a deficient formula. Not wrong. Don't go for it because it's wrong, because it isn't. But it doesn't give you what you want. What you want is the logos, or the information to do it with. And once you do that, and supply an egg, say even of a butterfly, and put it in the sardine can, and nothing else, you'll convert the sardines into butterflies, won't you? And they'll flutter around, you see. Have no difficulty with your cabbages in future years, because the butterflies will come and help you. Okay? Now, are there any questions you might like to ask about that? Because it's 1:15, I see. Have you understood me? Could you give a resume? Your teacher, I will ask you to test them and ask them to give an outline of what I said. And if they can do that, I would ask you to give those that do it really well, to give them, do you call them an A? Or do you call it, do you call it a 1? What do you call it here? Your top mark. You call it an A, do you? Well, I would recommend him, because you're such decent people, to give you an A, if you can give a reasonable outline of what I've told you this morning. I said there were 2 answers to what I said this morning. One was a, and the other one was a, so where have we got to now? Which is it? Did you understand me? Okay, there you are, your teacher, you've heard, and they seem to have understood, so I've delivered my soul from destruction in that I've told you that evolution is a totally unscientific concept. You can't repeat it. You ought to be able to repeat it if it's scientific, and you can't. The only way to do it is to put that in, the information, which Darwin refused to put in. He refused to have any concept put in, or any logos put in. And he took it out and hoped that the formula would stand up without it. And it won't. It works perfectly with it, but it doesn't without it. Right, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, you can ask them. Yes, sir. You can repeat it. We've done it. You see, you can repeat it as often as you like. Here, for example, if you want to make life, Saul Spiegelman did that in Chicago 20 years ago. He took all the matter which was necessary to make life, and he put in the biochemical know-how, the program, and out came a living virus, if you can call a virus living. But the virus attacked the cell and lived there symbiotically with us. So what he did was took the sardines, as it were, the material, and he put in the program by hand. He didn't put it in as a spore. He put it in by hand, chemically, step for step. And the result was, he did work 2 years on that with all his assistants. He was a brilliant man. Put the program in step by step. Not synthetically as a spore, but just simply by hand, stage by stage. And the result was a virus. Now, Arthur Kornberg did the same thing. One of them did it with an RNA molecule, another one did it with a DNA molecule, both of which they synthesized. And the result was life. So we can repeat it as often as you like. Now, the second thing is this, that Darwin said that if you wanted to get a new species, you did it by sex. That is, you bred the things. Well, we've never done it by sex. But what we have done is done it by cloning. If you take Escherichia coli, here's the round Escherichia coli, and here's the DNA molecule. If you open the information storage and retrieval system so that it's open here, can you all see that, more or less? If you open it, and then you put inside the program for a human insulin gene, there's the program for the human insulin, you put it in, you get a new form of Escherichia coli, which makes Escherichia coli, but also makes human insulin, and that's how human insulin is made today. So you've made a new species of Escherichia coli, but put in a new program. Now, if you think that programs are made by random processes, then I have you all certified. You've got to have the program put in, and then the thing will live. So this is a scientific fact. You can repeat it as often as you like. Darwin was wrong because he didn't know. But it's wrong to go on teaching people what he thought was right because he didn't know that he was wrong. It's wrong to go on doing that. That's all. Okay. Not a question of propaganda or politics or anything like that. It's a question of scientific fact. Right. Okay, thank you. I nearly got myself... Any more questions? All questions clear? Is it high or no? Okay, right, we are then. Now we're going to talk to the school after this, and I've got another little story for the whole school, so we'll see what we do with that one.
Thank you.
Okay.